In the coming week, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo wraps up his Central European trip in Poland. The Democratic National Convention is set to take place virtually, and the Special Tribunal for Lebanon is due to give its verdict on the killing of former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri. It's August 13th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's get started this week by talking about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's tour of four Central European countries. He's set to visit the Czech Republic, Slovenia, Austria, and Poland. I imagine this is going to be a very busy trip for Secretary Pompeo. Can you tell us a little bit about what's on the agenda for his visits?
Yes, Jim. So it's in actually mid-train now. He's got ahead of him Austria and Poland as we sat down to do this. I think he's still in Slovenia right now. He kicked it off in the Czech Republic with a speech to the Czech Parliament, which was on or around the 30th anniversary of Václav Havel's historic speech in the U.S. Congress in 1990. Which came after then Czechoslovakia had sloughed off the bonds of communism and emerged as a democracy. And Václav Havel came sort of celebrated to the United States. Mike Pompeo sought to channel that excitement. But what's been interesting, and I think will be worth watching as this trip goes on, is his speech. One would have imagined his speech talking a bit about authoritarianism, especially as it pertained to Russia, the big neighbor that's still causing concern in the region. But he spent most of his speech talking about China and the threat posed by China. And one of the themes that is already playing out as it pertains to that threat is he's trying to work with these countries to sort of turn elsewhere than the giant Chinese tech company Huawei in setting up their 5G networks. He's talking about the threat China poses, that the way China is seeking to leverage its influence. He repeatedly referred to, as he has been referring to, the Chinese Communist Party, sort of channeling the word communist over and over again, as a malign actor that is seeking to spread its influence around the world. Including in Central Europe. The Czechs have had their own run-ins with China, especially the mayor of Prague, who's been cultivating relationships with Taiwan. So they heard that, but I think other than one, I think it was one line of passing reference to Russia, I think there was a bit of head-scratching about that. What you're also seeing on this trip, though, is, and again, in Slovenia now, Secretary Pompeo has talked about the importance of setting up the 5G networks. I think he's got Slovenia's agreement that it's going to work on a non-Chinese network, a commercial 5G network. I think they're going to work with the Swedish telecom company Ericsson, actually. But he's also talking about things like energy security on this trip. And this is where Russia gets involved. And the United States wants to get both Western and Eastern European countries kind of moving away from dependence on Russia for vast oil and gas reserves and to diversify. And part of that diversification wants to be with the United States, whether it's, you know, U.S. fossil fuels or, you know, even promoting nuclear energy. So there's a message that Secretary Pompeo is delivering to these countries that is very much consistent with the administration's line as it pertains to China, as it pertains to energy. And also, there's a hearkening back a little bit to what we heard in and around the Gulf War of what Secretary, I think it was Donald Rumsfeld, called the New Europe. You know, these states that were more supportive of the U.S. efforts against Iraq in 2003. And so he's focusing just on four countries, although Austria is an exception, but he's focusing on countries that were formerly under communism.
Well, except for Austria.
Except for Austria, right. He's focusing on countries that are former communist states that the U.S. message about freedom, about democracy, about like-minded nations could resonate. Again, another curious aspect to the big speech in Prague, which was his biggest address to date on this trip, was not too much mention of, actually, I'm not sure if he mentioned Belarus at all. He mentioned Belarus subsequently in an interview with Radio Free Europe in Prague. But here you have in the neighborhood, a country, you know, in the grips of a crisis, people going to vote and sort of dealing with classic ballot stuffing, and then a really harsh reprisal by the government against opposition.
Right. Well, Mr.
supporters.
Lukashenko won, air quote, a commanding victory, though apparently many Belarusians don't agree that he's the one they voted for.
So it could have been an opportunity for the U.S. Secretary of State appearing in a major allies parliamentary chamber to talk about the importance of supporting the free aspirations of Belarusian people. He did do that in his interview at Radio Free Europe, although again, he didn't mention it. It was really a speech, if you read through the transcript of the speech delivered in the parliament, it was really, you know, 75% or so about China. We'll see how he wraps up. He's got Poland this weekend. Poland is an interesting case because some of the troops that have recently reported to be cycling out of Germany Germany are going to be cycling into Poland in pretty small numbers. However, there have been at any one time 4,000 or so U.S. troops as part of a contingent that has been deployed in Poland as a show of solidarity, as a show against Russia of any sort of assertiveness that it might be harboring towards Poland. And so Secretary Pompeo, who's been, it must be said, more outspoken in his warnings about Russia than President Trump has been, we'll see what he has to say about that on the trip to Poland and any sort of new U.S. commitments to troops in Poland.
And I take it Secretary Pompeo made no public remarks about concerns of the shift toward authoritarianism in Europe and specifically in Central Europe, correct?
That is correct. Poland will be the first of the countries he's visiting where you've had a real surge towards populism and authoritarianism in terms of a government that is trying to seize the reins of power and take advantage of it to suppress opposition media, to take over the judiciary. Hungary is much further along in that way. This administration has maintained cordial relations with both of those countries. And so that's another interesting wrinkle as part of this trip as well, Jim.
Yeah, I noticed that the trip doesn't include Hungary. Should we read anything into that, or this is just a natural rotation of trips? You can't go everywhere on a visit.
It's an interesting point, Jim. I don't know, because you have, you know, countries like Austria bordering on Hungary. You have it's right there. It would not have been too long of a trip to fit in. I'm not sure. There's all sorts of calculations going to trips like this. So I'm not sure. I have not seen anything about whether there is some signal or some sort of implicit message as far as Hungary goes. You know, Hungary continues to move in the direction it's moving in under President Orban. And again, he's maintained pretty decent relationships with the Trump administration. He has cultivated pretty warm relationship with Russia. So it could be, and I don't know the state of Hungary's ties with Russia in terms of on energy, for example, whether that was just seen as a non-starter. The reports out of Prague were that the secretary's message on China got some mixed reception from Czechs who, again, while they don't have necessarily a warm embrace with China, they want to keep their options open. And certainly they would like to keep some Chinese investment coming into the country and don't see China in sort of the same kind of Manichaean struggle the way the Trump administration does.
Well, Bob, I think you put your finger on an important element there, which is that China has been, at least until the last several months, been coming around with an open checkbook, being very interested in investing in countries. And these countries in Central Europe, like countries around the world, are very interested in investment. We are in a global recession. Getting outside investment matters more, though. Obviously, the Chinese are in a bit different position now because they themselves are facing strong economic headwinds. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because this actually leads to some significant division within Europe, within the EU, about whether or not one should take money from China, or whether it is in some sense a gift that will come back to haunt you.
You're absolutely right, Jim. And it continues to play out in Western and in Eastern Europe. And this issue of Chinese technology, Chinese misinformation, which is bothering a lot of capitals, but also Chinese largesse, you know, and can you consider a country like Germany trying to sort of balance out the issues? And it is a tough position to be in. So we're going to hear more on this front, definitely. Jim, I want to bring us back home to the U.S. because there's a convention taking place in this pandemic summer, and that's the Democratic National Convention. It's going to be held in Milwaukee at the Wisconsin Center. Now, it's going to be a largely virtual convention because of the ongoing threat posed by COVID-19. In fact, just yesterday, I think there was reported 1,500 deaths in the U.S., which is the most since May, I believe. So how will this year's convention be conducted? What should we be looking for in a virtual party convention nominating a presidential candidate?
Well, Bob, the first thing is that you can forget having large, boisterous crowds interrupting the nominee's speech with sustained applause and then thousands of balloons falling from the rafters. Like you say, most of the standard convention activities are going to take place online this year. So this is a new or novel event and sequence for all of us. Now, the Wisconsin Center will have some in-person events, but my understanding is those are going to be limited to about 250 people at most, and they will mainly be press security, medical consultants, DNC staff, and some of the speakers who are coming from Wisconsin, so not traveling that far, may give their speeches live there. But pretty much everyone else is going to be doing things virtually. There are no out-of-town speakers headed to Milwaukee for the convention. Now, the convention's broad theme is Uniting America, and it will, in terms of the layout, follow the general rhythm that we've grown used to in looking at big party national national conventions. Rival candidates are going to come up and speak to endorse the nominee and build party unity. So Bernie Sanders, Senator from Vermont, will speak on Monday night. Elizabeth Warren, Senator from Massachusetts, on Wednesday night. We're going to see former presidents speak. Bill Clinton is set to speak on Tuesday night. Barack Obama speaks on Wednesday night. The vice presidential nominee, which the Biden campaign, former Vice President Biden announced this week, Senator Kamala Harris of California, will give her big address on Wednesday night. And now, some of these speeches will be live. Some of them will be recorded. It's not really clear who's giving speeches live and who's doing it recorded. But Thursday, a week from today, is going to be Joe Biden's day. That's when he will accept the nomination virtually. He's going to speak from somewhere near his home in Delaware. The exact location and the details of the speech haven't been announced. And it's unclear what's going to happen after the convention. You may recall in the past, typically after you have a convention, the nominee and the vice presidential nominee go off on a tour, visit cities, give speeches, press the flesh. Well, obviously, in this time, you're not going to be able to do any of those sort of activities. So the post-convention stretch in activities is a bit unknown. Now, I just want to say sort of two things in closing about this convention. One is for history buffs, the other is for economists. For history buffs, in some ways, this convention is going to be a throwback to the way we used to do conventions in the United States. Up until FDR in 1932, the tradition was that a presidential candidate, a nominee, did not go to the convention to accept the nomination. They would sort of stay at home while the rabid party members went to whatever city was hosting the convention, and then the nominee would say, thank you very much. FDR, again, broke that tradition in 1932 when he went to Chicago to the Democratic National Convention to accept the party's nomination, and that really changed sort of the way subsequent nominees approach things. The other thing is that when you look at this, the change in the operation is going to be a big hit economically for the people of Milwaukee. And we talk about political party conventions. They're not just political events. They're also big economic events. I mean, you have, you know, hotels, meals, catering, and the like. It can bring a lot of money into a city, and Milwaukee is going to be missing out on all of that.
Yeah, Jim, it's an interesting point you're saying about the history of conventions. They also, from my sort of browsing of history, were also places where actually some work got done in the selecting of candidates in certain cases where you had the sort of so-called backroom discussions, and there were all sorts of sometimes fierce discussions going on about who would be better, and then there were rounds of votes taken and everything else. A lot of in-person, though, discussions that were crucial that is basically not really in the equation now. Obviously, there is a ticket. It's all but a done deal that they are getting the party's nomination. Though I'm wondering about the coalescing of the party, though, behind a uniting theme, and how much this sort of distancing of everything is going to take steam out of a crucial moment for some momentum.
Well, that's a big question, Bob, and I don't think anyone really knows the answer to that. You're quite right that part of the function of a political convention is for people to get together, and you hope that you're going to be able to resolve the rifts that have been opened up either by the campaign or that existed before the campaign began. Sometimes that works really well. You bring people together. Think 2008, Barack Obama has a long and pretty contested campaign against Hillary Clinton, but the sides come together and the Democrats present a unified front to the country versus, let's say, stay on the theme of Democratic conventions, 1968, which was perhaps one of the most tumultuous political conventions of our era. We have major protests over the Vietnam War, the police using extreme force, excessive force against the protesters, shouting and screaming on the convention floor, a lot of heartburn divisions that were never really resolved before we go into the campaign. The Democrats, Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, lost a narrow election to Richard Nixon, then I guess of California. And so this is sort of the question, to what extent not having people in the room, whether you wanted to call it or describe it as making deals or just talking to one another, building coalitions, we're not going to have that. I do think that for the Democrats coming out of this convention, they are in a situation in which the party is fairly unified. Certainly, I would say more unified than people thought it might be, to judge by the press writings back, let's say, January and February. We talk about this bitter divide between Bernie Sanders and what would the Sanders supporters do if Sanders didn't become the nominee. Barnier. And I think Senator Sanders, clearly to his credit, has tried to telegraph to everybody involved that he views defeating Donald Trump on November 3rd as being job one for the Democrats, and that they have to come together, even as Democrats disagree on the particulars of, let's say, Medicare for All or the exact use of U.S. leadership abroad. So I think the Democrats are going into this as a party that looks to be unified. Now, whether that's sufficient come November 3rd is an entirely different question, because as we've discussed many times on this podcast, we live in a country that has significant political polarization. So it's quite possible that Democrats can become unified. It can also be possible that the Republicans become quite unified. And then we'll see what happens in November and who can turn out or get their voters to send in ballots.
So, as you said, in Milwaukee, there will be a number of high-profile Democrats speaking from various locations and some activity going on in the Wisconsin Center. There will also be a party platform coming out, which has an element of foreign policy in it. Is this something that we should be looking for, some sort of manifesto, some sort of, you know, counter to Trump sort of worldview? Or what should we look for in terms of a foreign policy convention?
Well, it's a good question, Bob, and I would actually broaden it out. And the question is, to what extent will foreign policy feature in the platform? More important, to what extent will it feature in Joe Biden's campaign message to the American people? My guess is that foreign policy will get a mention. Obviously, former Vice President Biden prides himself on his long involvement in foreign affairs. But I think at this moment, it's safe to say that most Americans want to hear what the President of the United States is going to do to address the very real problems that they face in their daily life. Again, the country is beset by a pandemic. We've been unable to get it under control. It has disrupted life. It has disrupted the economy. People are facing eviction. People have lost their job or worried about losing their job. So I think that's going to be the main focus. Now, one would think that what the Biden campaign will try to do is to knit together a message which relates the foreign policy it intends to pursue with its domestic policy, that in some sense are unified in reinforcing. So I would imagine, again, one of the things you will hear from the Biden campaign, and we've already heard it, that a President Biden would work with other countries to get a coordinated response to the coronavirus, that we work on vaccines together, that we would enhance the distribution. And again, all in the service of a broader message of getting America back up on its feet, running again. I think that's what they're going to be shooting for. Whether they can actually deliver that message is an entirely different thing. Obviously, one thing to draw something up, another thing to actually execute it. Because again, Republicans are going to do what the opposition party does, is try to chip away at it and expose inconsistencies and contradictions and incoherencies. And Democrats will do it in reverse to the Republicans. But I think Biden's main message is really going to be domestically focused, not to suggest that foreign policy is unimportant, but that I think is where voters are right now, and they want to be assured that he has a plan for getting America out of the funk that it's in right now.
And also, as you mentioned, a chance to see whether the new ticket now with Kamala Harris, with bringing diversity to the ticket, who has a story including Jamaican and Indian parents and record as both a prosecutor, but someone else who's going to speak out on criminal justice issues. It's a different element than we're going to see in the following week, I think, with the Republicans.
Certainly so. And there's going to be and has been a lot of ink spilled by journalists and political strategists trying to figure out the consequences of the choice and how it will affect the outcome of the race. I'm trained as a political scientist. Most of the work political scientists do suggest that the selection of a vice president only affects things on the margins. They don't really move large blocks of people. But obviously, as we've talked about before, if you have a deeply divided country, it's highly polarized. Things are split 50-50. If you can move people on the margins, that can be the winning ticket. Anyway, Bob, let's shift gears and talk about a country that's faced a tumultuous few weeks. I'm talking about Lebanon. In the coming week, judges at the Special Tribunal for Lebanon are due to give their verdict in the trial of four men accused of the 2005 Beirut bombing that killed Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik al-Hariri and 21 others. Can you tell us a bit about the background of the case, Bob, and particularly why it's coming to a head now, 15 years later?
Sure, Jim. First, it must be said that it's hard to imagine a more tumultuous time for this to be coming out in a country that's had its share of tumult in the last, certainly the last half century. But dates back to the 2005 bombing. It was a massive bombing in downtown Beirut. The prime minister, one of, if not the wealthiest individuals in the country, real sort of power broker in his own right, even before he was prime minister, and then seeming to be involved in nudging Syria aside as a major influence in Lebanon, he is killed. And then 21 or 22 others, depending on the reports you've seen, killed as well. It created a great deal of unease and a great deal of concern about who was behind it. It seemed to certainly have the hands of some sort of powerful clandestine force that did not want Hariri around anymore. Suspicion and investigation centered on these four individuals who were said to be linked to Hezbollah. I think a lot of it, from what I've read, was based on cell phone mining of data from mobile phones. So a court is created in 2007 to investigate. It's a court that's based in The Hague. It's under UN auspices. There's a lot of discussion in the UN Security Council about this case as well. This is an independent court. It's largely, but not completely, made up of Lebanese magistrates. It's got some international magistrates involved. It's sort of UN has several of these in its constellation of these so-called hybrid courts, so that it's based on local law, but also international law. And in any event, long time compiling information on this, and great deal of anticipation. Obviously, if the four individuals are found guilty, it casts a sharper light on Hezbollah, which is already facing a bit of extra scrutiny amidst Lebanon's massive woes at the moment. It also retains a great deal of power still as a Shiite entity that's both a political party, a militant group, and has involvement in social networks in Lebanon as well. So it just took a long time for this to percolate, for all the interviews to be held. The four individuals, it must be said, the four defendants are being tried in absentia. It's not exactly clear where they are. Hezbollah has denied any involvement in the killing of Hariri. Hariri, by the way, is a Sunni Muslim. And so it's not clear then, you know, if they are found guilty, which some suspect, then following that is sentencing, and their whereabouts is unknown. Hezbollah is denying involvement. What happens next in that case? Does it become a more vehement effort to find them? Is there become some sort of international manhunt? Is there further controversy that roils Lebanon, which is already, it's hard to imagine how it can be further roiled right now in the aftermath of this devastating explosion last week. So there's so much intrigue surrounding this, Jim. There was already going to be a great deal. And now on top of it all, with a country seemed to be teetering on verge of being a failed state, it's just adds another layer to it. And again, I think a lot of it is about what it means for Hezbollah and its ability to remain as a viable part of sort of the Lebanese leadership, such as it is.
Bob, can I ask you to unpack that last point about the potential ramifications of this court verdict with the current state of politics in Lebanon and Beirut? It seems that the government of Lebanon has resigned. Would this really make much of a difference, or is it that Lebanon really has sort of fallen apart and this is not even going to move the needle much because of all the other problems overwhelming that political system?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think, given the way things have unfolded since the explosion, I think you're right. It's like, what impact does it have on a government that barely exists? It's really a country of factions. But it's a country that heavily depends, and will increasingly in the days and years to come, heavily depends on the international community, the UN, major donor, to prop it up and to provide basics like foodstuffs and shelter, but also, you know, build up its institutions again, build up its infrastructure. And so you already see signs that, you know, there will be some conditioning potentially of aid to Lebanon, or the funneling of aid to Lebanon, based on where Hezbollah is in the equation. The United States is pretty strongly, you know, signaled it does not want to be funneling any aid through which Hezbollah can have any sort of control. By the way, the U.S. is involved in another matter involving Lebanon, which is whether or not to renew the peacekeeping mission, one of the largest UN peacekeeping missions in southern Lebanon, to keep peace between Hezbollah and Israeli forces. And the U.S. has said that Hezbollah has kind of gamed that peacekeeping mission to its advantage, and it wants to reduce the renewal of the mission under UN Security Council auspices by 6 months, not a year. It's facing an uphill battle on that front. But you could see some sort of bridging or ending of that mission on top of it all, because, again, this move by the U.S. to try to counter Hezbollah. So it's elements like that. You have the French, you know, taking a big role seemingly in trying to galvanize international support, but also, you know, maybe exert some control. France has for years been an influential player in Lebanon. So I think what's interesting to watch, Jim, going forward is the international influence in Lebanon, which has been it looks like it's going to enter into some sort of temporary or long-term quasi-receivership under UN or other international auspices.
Yeah, Lebanon is a tragic story. I mean, it's been a tragic story for decades now, going back to the outbreak of the Civil War in the mid-1970s, because I'm old enough to remember studying comparative politics and having people offer up Lebanon as a vision of a successful society that had extensive sectarian divisions and through its consociational government managed to work and to flourish, and Beirut was the Paris of the Eastern Mediterranean and the like, and the last 45 plus years have been filled with much more sorrow than success.
No, you're absolutely right, Jim. I mean, if anything, any sort of silver lining, it is like in some ways Afghan civilians, there is a resilience in Lebanon that's kind of remarkable. And you've seen it in some of the responses to the explosion where you've had brigades of civilian groups sort of showing up to clean up in the capital. They have actually a well-established NGO network, civil society network in the country that helps keep things functioning in the absence of a government. But just a combination of problems, self-inflicted and inflicted from outside, have created this circumstance now, and it's come to a really tragic state. Jim, we're at the point of our podcast where we talk about figures of the week. So please, who or what is your figure?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person. Now, under ordinary circumstances, I would go with Kamala Harris, who was, as we've just already spoken about, nominated or been picked by former Vice President Joe Biden to be his running mate in the campaign. I assume that the Democratic Convention, when it meets next week, will elevate her formally on the ticket. She's just the fourth woman to be on a major party presidential ticket here in the United States. As you mentioned, she's the first Black woman. She's also the first woman of South Asian descent to be on a major party presidential ticket. But since we've already sort of spoken about that, what I want to go with instead for my figure of the week is Jimmy Lai. He's a Hong Kong billionaire, owner of Apple Daily, which is one of Hong Kong's most widely read newspapers. And this past Monday, he was arrested, becoming the most prominent person in Hong Kong to be detained under Beijing's new national security law. His sons and several of his business colleagues were arrested as well. They were subsequently released on bail. Now, Jimmy Lai is actually a real-world Horatio Alger rags-to-riches story. So before I talk about the nature of the charges against him, I want to just sketch out a little bit about his history. He was born in mainland China back in 1948. In 1960, at the age of 12, he stowed away in a boat and made it to Hong Kong. He got a job working in a garment factory where his wages, I think, were the equivalent of something on the order of $8 or $10 a month. He managed to save. He's very ingenious. He eventually got himself in a position where he bought his own garment factory, and he built it into a worldwide brand. He branched out into a variety of other businesses, particularly into media companies. And along the way, he has been an avid advocate for democracy in Hong Kong. His arrest this past week was not the first time he's been arrested for his activism. But I think when he was arrested this week and the way he was arrested, with officials showing up at the headquarters of his firm, I think it's Next Digital, searching through the building for materials and taking things away, people's reaction has been that this arrest marks something different. He certainly thought so. He told the BBC after he was released from jail that this was just the beginning, signaling that Beijing is really going to use its new security law to aggressively repress dissent and end the freedoms that Hong Kongers currently enjoy. I will note, at least from the press reports, the specific charges against Jimmy Lai were very vague, something on the order of collusion with a foreign country or external elements, which was part of the new crime established by the security law. And I think, among other things, it shows that Beijing is not at all deterred by the criticism and the finger waving it has gotten from the United States and many of its allies in recent weeks over the new Hong Kong security law. Beijing intends to crack down. This obviously raises real problems for countries in the West, the United States, Great Britain, Australia, and the like, because they've been very critical of it. But their real levers to be able to change Chinese behavior are quite small and don't seem to be registering with the people who make decisions in Beijing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Everything I've seen and heard just seems like a further tipping point and showing the real intention of the mainland government to crack down and crack down with impunity. I mean, the big thing to look next is to what extent Hong Kong as a financial center is harmed by this. China does not seem to be worried by that, whether it's a short or long-term impact. They are moving straight ahead. And for them, it's about exercising their sovereign right to do what they want, despite the international agreements that were pretty firm concerning Hong Kong. The other issue is whether there's flight out of Hong Kong is something that really picks up and you see people following through on the offers like the UK made, for example, on allowing people to come there, and whether we just start seeing some irreversible movements happen happening and Hong Kong kind of recedes into history.
Yeah, I think it's quite likely you're going to see more flows out of Hong Kong. I think it has already begun. I think it began even before the security law passed. At least the people who have the wealth and capital to be able to move have created what might be called exit ramps or off ramps if they find Beijing's behavior intolerable. What about you, Bob? What is your figure of the week?
So, Jim, my figure is ripped from the breaking alerts that come in on my phone. My figure is 3, in that there are now 3 countries in the Arab world that have made peace with Israel and are normalizing relations, with the announcement today that the United Arab Emirates has agreed to do so. And the 3 are UAE, Egypt, and Jordan. This was big, rather unexpected news that the Trump administration proudly announced. What it seems to do initially is immediately sort of take off the table plans to annex the West Bank. That seemed to be part of the deal, was suspending those moves by Israel. For how long, I'm not clear on, Jim, but it sets up a kind of a new calculus, perhaps, in the Middle East with an Arab state playing a big role, and maybe a role that offers it some additional leverage with the Israeli government.
Well, I got to compliment you, Bob, on staying up with the news, because this story broke after we started recording the podcast. So 2 thumbs up for you. I know it's sort of hard to say what's in the deal since we don't know what's in the deal and what it actually means. But just sort of immediate reaction, do you have any reason to believe or suspect that any other countries in the Arab world might follow the UAE's lead? Or is this likely to be something where you get one country, but no one else is in a rush to follow suit?
Likely the latter, Jim, given the broad history of the region, but it's unclear. This is certainly something that, it must be said, the Trump administration has been working heavily on trying to bring about. It included, you know, as part of it, in addition to the big news involving the West Bank, there's all sorts of agreements that concern, you know, investment and security and technology and energy and other things. Israel is an economic dynamo in a region with a lot of faltering, poorly run regimes. So being able to do business somewhat unfettered is quite attractive. Israel, for some countries, is less the great pariah than it had been in the past. Certainly by suspending West Bank annexation moves makes it more palatable to some publics. But the so-called Arab street, I think, is still pretty potent in a number of these countries. So I'll go back to my initial response, which is I think this is it for now.
Any sense, Bob, as to why it's happening now? Because there has been a lot of loose talk for several years about a potential rapprochement between the Gulf countries. And usually people are talking about the Emiratis as well as the Saudis with Israel. Certainly that's been the policy goal of the Trump administration. So to the extent this has happened, they deserve, I guess, credit for helping that happen. But I mean, why now rather than a year ago or a year from now? Again, I'm asking you, I'm putting you in a difficult spot since this is breaking news and we don't know a lot, but any speculation, data-free speculation you want to engage in?
Sure. I mean, I could offer some conjecture, Jim, based on some of the reporting I've seen on it. And I will be actually looking closely to see what some of our colleagues, Martin Indyk, Stephen Cook, and others are saying and writing and tweeting about this in the days to come. But I think one thing you had was this, what seemed to be some impending decision by the Israelis to annex the West Bank. And that was being received with alarm in a lot of sections. And it was seeming like some sort of inexorable, inevitable step. And so potentially that kind of hastened what might have been talks that were kind of moving along already. And then who knows? On top of that, you know, there is just so much happening so quickly in the region involving alignments. And, you know, again, the U.S. role here, we might find out further about some sort of U.S. inducements to make this happen sooner rather than later, to notch a win in the Persian Gulf and to further create some sort of counter to Iran, perhaps. So I think it's a timing thing, maybe, Jim, in terms of Israeli moves, in terms of U.S. interest in countering Iran potentially. But being the Middle East, there's so many other factors involved. I will be keen to see what else emerges on some of the reporting on this.
Fair point. I suspect you're going to be spending a big chunk of your afternoon making sure that CFR.org and the experts at the Council on Foreign Relations help people make sense of this breaking news.
Yes, fair to say that, Jim. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi begins his official visit to the United States next week. And World Humanitarian Day is marked by the United Nations.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or a guest, not a CFR, which takes no institution positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This week, our recording engineer was none other than Zoe Collis. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying bye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.